No one likes to fall down. We don't sign up for it, but we can't escape it any more than we can escape gravity. And if we back up from it enough, I think that in our lives, falling down and getting up becomes a dance. And the question is not to avoid it, not to fight it. We don't have to seek it out either, but what is our rhythm?
Hello, I'm Julie Kroll. You're listening to the Dr. Julie Show, All Things Connected. Each week we gather right here to make connections that break through the illusion of separation. Welcome. Your journey of conscious evolution continues right here, right now. I fell and immediately started celebrating. Actually, it was more like a violent crash as I bounced on the pavement a couple of times and my glasses and flip-flops went flying. I was on an electric scooter riding with my husband. The wind came up and quickly blew my hat off. Without thinking, my reflex was to take my hands off the handlebars and catch my hat. The fall was imminent. As I rolled over from the unforgiving pavement to the soft green grass at the side of the trail, bleeding in several places, I felt an overwhelming sense of relief well up inside of me. And I began laughing and crying and celebrating and laughing some more. The first thing that went through my mind was an affirmation. I fell and didn't break a bone. It had been 7 years since I fell and broke 6 bones in my leg. In the post-trauma phase, I became deathly afraid of falling, to the point of being extremely cautious and avoiding a lot of low to moderate risk activities. And here I was, 7 years later, laughing and celebrating a major breakthrough. I was done being afraid of falling. My guest today says that while no one likes to fall down, it is how we grow. From a longer and deeper perspective, falling down and getting up is the inevitable rhythm of transformation. My literal fall that day was an experience of momentous transformation and growth. I needed that fall to bring me more fully into life. Are you afraid of falling? Perhaps it's time to shift your awareness. I invite you to take a few conscious breaths, bring your awareness to your heart, relax, open your mind, and settle into your essential wholeness as I introduce my guest. Mark Nepo is a poet, philosopher, and master teacher who has been convening circles and guiding retreats for more than 50 years all over the world. He is a number one New York Times bestselling author of 25 books. He has numerous awards and accolades and devotes his work to the journey of inner transformation and the life of relationship. And he is one of my favorite voices on the planet. Welcome back to the show, Mark.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. And I loved your sharing about your fall. What an amazing, amazing experience.
It was an experience. You know, the first fall was a very traumatic experience of breaking 6 bones in my leg. And then the second fall was so liberating. It was like breaking me open, like you talk about in the book in so many ways. And obviously, we're talking literal falls here, and I can't wait to dig into this other subject matter that you write about in the book. But first, before we get into the idea of falling, let's talk about all things connected. You write so many things about connection in all of your works. And here in this book, Falling Down and Getting Up, you wrote, "The poet's call is to reveal how the source of all reality empowers a good heart to sustain the web of life." From that perspective, Mark, you are a master poet.
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome. You're right. Pages of beauty and grace and ease about this connection with everything, right down to what we look at, who we are, in how we relate. I loved that phrase that you wrote in the book. Talk about the intricacies of this web of life and how this can empower us to really understand it and feel it.
And you know what? Everything, it does feel to me that everything is connected, and all the spiritual traditions in their own way speak about how we, when we love each other, when we care for each other, when we keep each other company during our suffering, we are enhancing and enlivening those connections. And that wholeness is restorative. So a couple of stories come to mind from different traditions. So the first one is, you know, where I live in Michigan, the Native American tribe that was native here is the Ojibwe Nation. And like many indigenous cultures, they have a constellation of creation stories, not just one. And part of their creation constellation of creation stories talks about the work of the worm. So it appears that once the Great Spirit created everything, he or she was contemplating how to connect everything. When all of a sudden a little worm inched over and said, "I can help." And the Great Spirit said, "Well, thank you, little worm. Please help us." So the little worm slowly inched and started spinning barely seeable silk threads from his guts. And sure enough, connected everything in the universe. And you know, when we've seen like a large spider web, and if it's not in the light, you almost don't see it, but it's there. But when the sun comes on it, oh my God, it's this magnificent web. And just like that, when the Great Spirit leaned over all these barely seeable threads, it all became clear. The worm had actually connected everything. And so the Great Spirit was pleased and said to the little worm, "Thank you, little worm. You have saved us, not by being brilliant or being great, but by being true to your own nature. I will let you live forever." Well, the little worm was taken aback and said, and the Great Spirit could see this and said, "Don't you want to live forever?" And the little worm said, "Oh, Father, I fear so many years if I can't grow." And so the Great Spirit said, "Very well, little worm. I will give you this ability to spin and weave and inch and squirm around yourself. And when you stop squirming and inching and weaving long enough, you will know the lightness of being that I know. Go." And the little worm inched to the nearest leaf and began to spin the very first cocoon, and in time became the first butterfly. And what I love about that story, anonymous, ancient, is that what holds things together is spun not even from the worm's head or heart, but from its guts. And what it says to us is that this shows the true inner work isn't just self-centered. It actually weaves the threads that holds everything together. That we must process, face what is ours to face, process it, digest it. And that introspection, that authentic holding and feeling of being you, well, in this case, the worm, but being alive, and for us human, actually does spin the threads that hold everything together.
I love that story too. It is just gorgeous. And even the metamorphosis that comes along with the story is so beautiful. And when you talk about the threads that are seen and unseen, it reminds me of your writing, because you talk about that as the soul's work. It reminds me of another quote you wrote. "It is this immersion into the depth of life that awakens our soul and makes the connection between things knowable. This immersion is our daily practice in being fully here." How gorgeous is that? Oh. Talk about that as our daily practice. Our daily work is to really look at that immersiveness into that interconnection.
And I think that, you know, being human, we can't do it all the time, and but I can be committed to it. And therefore, the whatever our spiritual practice, however personalized it is, I think it is always a practice of return. So I can be clear today and I'll be confused tomorrow. I will fall down tomorrow and get up. I will, you know, I can be safe and tomorrow feel afraid. And so we are always looking for what are the experiences, relationships, that will, and practices that will help us return. And they start with, for me, of always opening, especially when we're closed, holding nothing back, and giving our full attention to the nearest piece of life. You know, I think for me, one of the ways that I return is that I try to give my full attention to the nearest piece of life until it becomes my teacher.
I have a question about that opening in a minute, but you started to bring in the idea of falling down and getting up. So I want to give our listeners a little orientation to why you've titled the book this. In a chapter titled How to Fall and How to Get Up, you write, and this book is just delightful, small little chapters with questions at the end. It really is a journey. It's like it's a soul's journey for us, and it's so easy and just like delicious to just muse into. But in this chapter, you wrote, we are challenged to align ourselves with whatever current is causing us to fall. Contrary to being willful, we must learn to go with the force of life that is overtaking us and forget where we are going. Say more about that as we orient the listener to this book.
So this is, you know, and a way to speak about this is, you know, in the Taoist tradition, and the Tao just means in ancient Chinese, the way, that don't even try to name it. But the metaphor that comes is they speak about as if life is an invisible river and every soul is a fish in that river. And so the true purpose of will is to align with the current, not to fight it, not to think that we create the river or we control the current, but the true purpose of will is to find the larger currents of life and align with it. And when we do that, we are not only being who we are, but we gain more strength than we have because the current is taking us. And so, so with that in mind, you know, the whole falling down and getting up, and it was interesting because I mean, the title comes from in medieval times in Europe, medieval monks, when asked how to practice their faith, they said how they practiced their faith. They said by falling down and getting up. And I relate to that. And, you know, then it also reminded me of, and as I looked in other traditions, of course, many traditions have similar sayings. In Japanese, there's a saying that says, fall down 7, get up 8. And when I went through many years ago my cancer journey, you know, I remember I had a part of my journey, I had a rib removed from my back, and I woke up in the room after the surgery, and there was this kind but kind of gruff nurse leaning over me saying, get up, we're going to walk. And I thought, who's going to walk? And then she leaned over and got softer and said, 2 steps forward, 1 step back. Falling down and getting up, 2 steps forward. And then I learned when I was researching for the book that in the Upanishads, the Hindu anonymous holy texts, which are filled with amazing metaphors, there is one where there's a metaphor of how a caterpillar moves. It bunches up, in which it moves back, and then it stretches forward. And it bunches up, mm-hmm. and it stretches forward. And they suggest that this is the rhythm of spiritual growth. 2 steps forward, 1 step back, falling down, getting up. And so no one likes to fall down. We don't sign up for it, but we can't escape it any more than we can escape gravity. And if we back up from it enough, I think that in our lives, falling down and getting up becomes a dance. And the question is not to avoid it, not to fight it. We don't have to seek it out either. But what is our rhythm? What is our dance of falling down and getting up? And what do we learn from it? You know, one more thing here and then I'll pause. But I was teaching in September the first time from the book, and it was at a retreat center, a wonderful place in Connecticut, Mercy by the Sea. And there was an older nun in the group, and she was very present, but really didn't say anything. And then the last day, she raised her hand, and I think she was like 88, and she said, "You know, I fall down more than I ever did, and there are wonderfully lots of kind souls to help me up. But I've learned before they help me up, I ask them to wait because I need to feel the downness before I get up."
Wow.
That's beautiful wisdom.
That is beautiful wisdom. It's beautiful wisdom. You also talk about, here's a quote, "Ultimately, falling down and getting up are continuous forces like night and day or exhaling and inhaling. When skilled at both, a deeper, more expansive understanding of life is possible, indeed inevitable." There's the wisdom too. It's like this rhythm that you're talking about is when we learn that. Why do you think we're so afraid? I mean, I was afraid of falling because I broke bones.
Sure.
But in life, we're afraid of failure. We're afraid of humiliation. We're afraid of so many things. What is that in the human condition, and how can we really open to this rhythm and this transformation like you're suggesting?
Yeah, and I think that this has been something about in our human nature from the beginning of time, and every generation struggles with it, and it's like our turn. And I think that there is a suffering that comes from resisting authentic suffering. And when we try so hard, and in the Buddhist tradition, they actually speak about suffering, differentiating between pain and suffering. And in that tradition, they speak about suffering as trying to stop the wheel of life from turning, which is like an ant trying to stop the earth from turning on its axis. And all we do is create a second level of pain. And so I think that there is, and we do suffer this in our modern world even more, where we try to avoid the full range of what it is to be human. Oh, if I can, you know, I don't want to experience loss. I don't want to experience grief. I don't want to experience pain. Well, nobody does, but it's part of life. And it's the unity of all the different aspects of life that make it a miracle and restorative. And when we try to separate it, like, you know, if I were to say to you, if you were going to give me a glass of water, well, I just want the hydrogen, please. Even if you could do it, it would no longer be water and it would no longer be life sustaining. And so there's this mystery that I think that life has been made just difficult enough that we need each other to ensure the journey of love and to help us face and experience. And I think there is a thoroughness. So two things come to mind here as to why we have why we've gotten off track in over thousands of years. And, you know, one is we've had a misguided education about trying to be perfect rather than being fully human. And actually, in the translations into English of the early sayings of Jesus, and there's a wonderful book called Prayers for the Cosmos by Neil Douglas Klotz, which translated many of the sayings of Jesus from the original Aramaic, it's believed he spoke. And in doing that, he found a couple of really profound mistranslations. So when Jesus is often quoted as saying, "Be thou perfect," that's not what the original word meant. The original word in Aramaic meant, "Be thou wholehearted." That's a huge fork in the road in 2,000 years of education. So to be perfect is to eliminate our humanness, which actually removes us from life, makes us more frightened. But to be wholehearted is to be thorough, And that involves us leaning into life. And so another thing that has affected this in our evolution in the last several hundred years is, and this is another mistranslation or actually a misappropriation of words. So in English, actually there in Latin, there was a word centuries ago, daemonian. And this meant an angel that is affirming, or a spirit, an attendant spirit that is both affirming and challenging. And then somewhere along in the Elizabethan times, I don't know who, we don't know who, but that word was split into two words, angel and demon. And now the challenging aspect is seen as evil. And now we run from the challenges rather than lean into the challenges, because that's where transformation happens. So now we become more isolated. We're trying to be perfect. We're seeking only that which is affirming and running from that which is challenging. And we get further and further more isolated from life. And so this is, you know, the true, one of the true gifts of compassion is that that means I agree to keep you company and feel your pain. And that means we're in it together. So often people are afraid, and I'm sure you've experienced this, you know, in our life, my wife Susan and I, several years ago, we had a great period of loss. We lost both my parents, her mother, and a mentor of mine within about 18 months, and as well as our dog at the time. And we had friends who were afraid to go there with us. So they ran from, you know, from the grief. They ran from, you know, they pathologized the grief. They wanted us to be over it. And of course, all they had to do was say, wow, your grief frightens me. And you say, well, yeah, it frightens me too, but I'm here. And then we grow together. That brings us closer. And, you know, there's a young, a wonderful, wise young author, Valerie Kaur. I don't know if you know her work, but Sikh woman, really wonderful old soul. But she, in one of her books, says, we don't have to know someone to grieve with them. We grieve with them to know them.
Mm. Beautiful. Beautiful. You know, as you're talking about just being with each other, we're in these turbulent times, right? This turbulent era. And we're learning how we've been living under this spell of separation for quite some time. Neil Donald Walsh calls it the separation theology. Other people call it the illusion of separation. Even Einstein said the delusion of separation, right? At one point you mentioned moving from our grief, with our grief of the old world to the new world, working with all that life unearths in us. You said, you wrote, in this turbulent era, the world has fallen down and we must help each other up and begin again. So this is an important topic for our listeners at this time on the planet. Say more about moving from the old world to the new, Mark, and what does that mean in your perspective? Grief is a big part of it. Fear is a big part of it. Systems and structures break down, and we are not really seeing all the new emergent, beautiful structures that are really being built right under our noses. Most people don't see that.
Yeah, and I feel that the illusion of separation has been multiplied and more acute in the modern age, made by social media, by technology, by fear. The pandemic didn't help. And so I keep seeing people, more and more people having lost their direct connection to life. And I think this really was startling to me when, like so many people, I witnessed the insurrection and the January 6th and on TV like everyone else. And what's besides all, set aside all the politics, what was so like devastating to me was here were people being barbarically violent while taking pictures of themselves, as if they didn't know if this was real or a video game. And what that struck, and why that so struck me, is that if you have a direct connection in life, then you have a reverence with life. And if you have a reverence for life, you can't do harm. And so this is evidence, and all the traditions have practices, formal and informal traditions have practices for how to directly reconnect with life. And great love and great suffering have always returned us directly to life. And so I think that you know, we are each of us challenged to reach out, to step beyond our comfort zone, to listen more than talk, to give more than take, to keep loving each other forward, to remembering and finding what we have in common and not how we're different. And this keeps rehumanizing us to each other. You know, I remember years ago, my exercise through the decades has changed depending on what works. And in my 30s, I played racquetball. My 20s, I played basketball. And in my 30s, I remember distinctly, I was in a grocery line and there was an older woman, probably my age now, an older woman. And she was obviously had something wrong with her back. She was moving so slow. And I remember being in the line, feeling sympathy. And then honestly, I got impatient. Well, a couple of weeks later, I tweaked my back playing racquetball. Now, all of a sudden, I got it. And ever since then, if I see someone like that ahead of me online, I go carry their groceries. Because this is the evolution of compassion. And that's just one small example. And every day we're challenged. And this is one of the things that gets in the way for us too in the modern era, which I have begun to talk about as screen mentality. So we are so conditioned by all of the devices we're on. And technology is great. Look at us. We're here together right now. So technology is a tool. It's like a screwdriver or a hammer. You know, there's nothing inherently wrong with a tool. It's what we do with it and how we use it or how we let it use us. So I think we have started unconsciously to have this screen mentality where we change the channel. It's not real. There's a distance between us and whatever we're watching. And that is carrying over into real life. So when I am in the parking lot and I see someone fall down, I go, oh, that's too bad. And I change the channel in my mind and get in the car. No, this is real. There's nothing between me and that woman or man in the parking lot. So this is also what I mean by we have to regain our direct connection and experience life through our heart. There is nothing between each other. It's all very real. And this is one of the trappings of modern technology. You know, we have this 24/7 news cycle. Well, the real value of that is that, and I remember all the way back with 9/11, and my wife Susan and I were in Montreal. We were coming home after a weekend, and we happened to see it live from the hotel, the planes going into those towers. And, you know, we've seen that image hundreds of times. Well, the only value of that is for 100 people to see it once, not for you or me to see it 100 times. And so we have to begin to compensate for progress. You know, we physically, you know, 150 years ago, we didn't need gyms and yoga and health clubs because it took a lot of work to cut wood and have heat and get food. And, well, I don't want to go back. I like turning the lights on, you know. But we've had to get have physical aerobics to compensate for the cost of progress. Well, now we're at a point we need spiritual aerobics to compensate for the cost of progress. Because we are in a place where not only is there screen mentality, but, you know, my father, when I grew up, he never traveled much, but so we subscribed to National Geographic because he liked to look at the pictures from around the world. Well, you and I'm never going to climb Mount Everest, but I can Google and actually watch a video over someone's shoulder climbing Mount Everest. And that's okay until I think because I did that, I made the climb. I didn't make the climb. I watched the climb. And there's a difference. And we are also suffering in our society that by watching, we think we've experienced something. We think that that we lived it. And there is no substitute for living it.
Yeah. You write a lot about experiencing life. I really appreciate you bringing in this topic of all of our screen time and even the games. When you're talking about the insurrection at the Capitol, of how we can be in violence and take photos with that disconnect. You had a quote here, every day we are called to return to our simple, direct experience of life, loving whatever is before us until it opens, so it in turn can open us. So let's expand on this, because it's precisely what you're asking and inviting us. You know, we didn't climb the mountain. We watched a video of it. For those who might feel weary or impatient or even worse than that, loving whatever is before us until it opens. Some of us are like, what do you mean open? And how can I love it more than what I love? And what is that opening? So it can seem like a huge burden or trauma for some when they're in that waiting. They're in that, I'm loving this and my situation's not changing. So talk about this as a falling down moment of this need for this to open and nothing's shifting, nothing's happening. What do you mean by that? And how do we engage the heart to really hold that experience in the fullness of it? In the pain of it, in the everything of it.
Yeah. So I think there are two. This is part of a paradox, and I think in the book I do, or maybe it's, I can't remember. It might have been the book before, but there's a wonderful haiku by, he was actually a samurai, Masahide, Japanese samurai in the 16th century, who gave. Put his sword away. I would have loved to talk to this guy, like what happened, and went to study with the great poet Basho. And his one very famous haiku goes like this. My barn having burned to the ground, I can now see the moon more completely. Hmm. My barn having burned to the ground, I can now see the moon more completely. And what this opens for me is just what you were leaning into, is that there is no bypassing or rationalizing or minimizing the burning of the barn. That is real. That has its own deep teachers, loss, grief, pain, things not going as we imagined, and oh my God, there's a vastness I didn't know was there now that the barn is out of the way. I think in some ways, you know, Leonard Cohen's amazing song, Hallelujah, and he talks about the broken hallelujah, is really about this as well. When he, you know, and an image for me is that, you know, if you and I are on a raft at sea and a huge wave crashes our raft and now we're clinging to it, well, that's difficult for us. That might even be a tragedy. We don't, you know, and yet it does not diminish the majesty of the sea. Hallelujah. And how do we are challenged, and again, by going back to these simple things, instead of looking, see, one of the menacing assumptions made more acute in modern life, but it's always been there, is the menacing false assumption that life is other than where we are. It's over there.
Right.
If I could just get over there, or if I'm alone and I see a couple walking down the street, oh, if I could just be like them, or if I could have this much money, or this position, or this, or this, or this. And what that does is it doubles the difficulties we go through because we think life is other than where we are. And so when we can give our heart, again, our heart's attention, and this is why it is overwhelming. You know, we look at the world and all the difficult and the suffering and the pain, and we can do what we can, but we can't, if we try to solve it all, it will depress us. It will enervate us. And all we can do is give our full attention to whatever seam of the universe is right there. It's one of those barely seeable threads that the worm wove. Because when we feel that, we feel the whole web. And so it's, whether it's a fly on a window or what it might be, whatever we can give ourselves to, not what we're looking for, but what's there. And that doesn't rationalize what we're working for, what we're looking for, but it right sizes it. It right sizes it. And, you know, I was teaching, where I'm going back in February, but I was teaching this past year in Mexico at the Modern Elder Academy, a wonderful place. And before the retreat started, and this is one of these amazing stories. I so love being with people and their wisdom surfacing. And so before the retreat started, I had breakfast with a woman who was going to be in the retreat, and we went for separate walks on the beach, and she went her way. And then about 10 minutes later, she found me and she said, "I know we're not starting, but can I, something happened and I don't know what to make of it. Can I talk to you about it?" And that question alone is just, we should be asking that question all the time now. Something happened and I don't know what to make of it. Can we look at it together? And what happened to her was she had walked on the beach, and after about 5 minutes, she saw a rather sizable fish that was on the sand that had gotten somehow thrown out of the water. And she was like, "Oh, I don't know what to do. And do I let nature take its course, or do I try to put it back in the water?" And she found some driftwood and she put it back in the water. And then she walked another 5-10 minutes, and there was another fish on the shore out of the water. And so she came to me to say, "What, you know, I don't know what to make of this." And what we talked about was that, you know, we can use the fact that we can't save every fish as a way to enervate us, to say, "Oh, why bother?" But I don't think we're here to save every fish. I think the noble journey of being a spirit in a body in time on earth is to save the one fish in front of us, knowing there'll be another. It's a form of Sisyphus. It's, you know, how Camus talked about in his myth of Sisyphus, that really we have to love and honor the journey and the struggle. And it's not about how many fish we save. It's that we give to the one fish in front of us. And that's what we can do every day. You know, I think that one of the things I've learned over time, you know, our mind is a great tool, but it can't address everything. The heart can address more. And I learned this quite by accident, that when I can't remember what the problem was or what I was trying to struggle with, but I couldn't solve it. I couldn't figure it out. And then quite by chance, a friend called up in need. And so I dropped what I was struggling with and gave. And I discovered that by giving, my mind was cleared. By giving, I could see more possibilities. So when you can't think your way through, give. give, it will not just make you feel better, it will actually open our minds further and deeper. So there's a small poem of mine that speaks to this. It goes, it's just a stanza, but it goes, the mystery is that whoever shows up when we dare to give has exactly what we need hidden in their trouble.
That's beautiful. That's beautiful. You know, that giving piece literally changes our biochemistry too. People think, oh, it's good for our heart, and it is good for our heart. And literally it's changing our biochemistry. It's good for our health. It's good for everything, right?
Yes. Yes, absolutely.
So that shift from grief, from trauma, from pain, you're inviting us to lean into it, Mark. And sometimes it feels overwhelming, but there's a promise there. And beyond the poet and the spiritual teacher of you, how, not beyond, but encompassing that, how do we manage those states? Is giving the best way through? I'm thinking about when I fell. In my opening, when I talked about that fall, it literally brought me back into my body. And that broken leg and recovering from the broken leg, which was a multiple year journey of recovering from that trauma, that changed my life. It created so much immense beauty and wisdom and lessons in my life that were so profound. And I couldn't have planned that, right? So you talk about that too, is that when we let go of the grief, the pain, the fear, the backing up, and we lean in, the potential's immeasurable, imaginable, like what might be on the other side, like that burnt down barn.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, and it's not to, you know, to deify suffering. I mean, the truth is that every person will be given the chance to be dropped into the depth of life. Often it's something difficult that opens that for us. For me, it was cancer. But it doesn't have to be a life-threatening. It could be wonder or grace or being loved unconditionally for the first time or beauty. So it's not just that suffering opens us to this. And once we're dropped into the depth of life, then our deeper journey begins, and because it breaks our self-reference and everything becomes relational. And so there is no minimizing or reframing the difficulty. It's that we are shaped. You know what? I think having suffered, I've seen, I don't think I would have seen this if not for what I went through, but I think that suffering is for human beings what erosion is for nature. No one signs up for it again. We don't, you know, this is the forces of life. And we are shaped by life. And that opens, it's almost as a paradox where over time, if we're blessed to hold each other up, everything that can break will, so that all that's left is what's unbreakable. And we can't choose that or plan it or design it, but our humanity and our connection is what helps us endure that and find what's endearing about life. And so, you know, the truth is that not every time that we break, oh, there's some marvelous wisdom and transformation. No. We take turns. Today, I might break open, and tomorrow, I might just break. But we take turns so that when I break and you break open, you can help me, because we'll switch. And then when I'm broken open, I can help you. And so, you know, I don't think there's any answering to the question why. Why will drive you mad? And therefore, I think the most important question is how. How do we live? How, and truth is that, you know, fear and pain And I'll tell you, I don't know if we have time, or we may be running out of time. But fear and pain, we are constantly right-sizing them. Grief is a whole nother story. Grief changes everything forever. When there's a great paradox that when we lose someone, and we can grieve more things than a person, but when we lose someone dear, the landscape as we know it is blown up. And therefore, the maps we've carefully made over the years are useless because the landscape is different. And just when we don't want to go back into life, we're forced to make new maps.
That's a profound metaphor. And I love you differentiating the grief with these other pieces. And I also just want to bring it to the simplicity of life too, the subtle experience of life. We're talking about really heavy things and breaking open here, but you encourage us to listen to the soul on a daily level, to be fully engaged, to lean into life, and to just welcome that. And I love the idea of the river that you talked about. It's just like being in that river. Sometimes it knocks us over. The current is wild and crazy, and sometimes it's so refreshing, and we get to play and splash and what have you. You had a I wrote down several statements that were just one sentence, that I have a whole page of them, Mark, that I don't know. I'm going to have to put them on social media or something. They're so beautiful.
Oh, thank you.
Here's one. We as human beings suffer the tendency to inflate or deflate our sense of self and the nature of experience. It's like, oh, yeah, we do. We don't just live in the truth of who we be sometimes. There's so many of these here. I love them. In every situation, all things are possible. But here's one of my favorite. I'm going to repeat this. I'm going to pause and say, this is one of my favorite sentences in the whole book. Okay, listen to this one. In every situation, all things are possible, but none are true yet. None are true yet. Wow, that is such a profound sentence.
Well, this invites a practice for each of us, and that is, it's very human when we're facing things, whatever they might be, to rehearse the possibilities. What if? What if? What if this in a good way? What if this in a bad way? What if this? And but then we're asked to return to what we know and where we are, because all things are possible, but none are true yet. And so we have to come back, and that's a practice to come back to. And this also raises that we need to recover our intimacy with the unknown. The modern world has made the unknown catastrophic. Yes, catastrophe can happen, but so does beauty and wonder and love. After all, there isn't a friend or a person that I've loved in my life that I ever planned to love.
Wow. I love, see the simplicity of that and the just the subtle shifts that we make by tuning into moment by moment presence here and really trusting in life itself to move us. Here's another one you wrote. I remembered how many times I had not listened to the truth of my soul, silencing my inner teacher so as not to displease others. How many times I had bridled my own heart to avoid conflict or tension. This is a powerful lesson here. How do we grow out of this? This is a spiritual epidemic. People,
Yeah.
I don't avoid conflict. I don't want to displease you. I don't want to speak my truth. How do we resolve this one, Mark?
Well, I think that when we, and again, I don't know, but I can speak to it. I think that when, one of the gifts of your falling down and my having cancer is that it reminds us in a felt way how rare it is to be here at all. And when we remember that, we are returned to the consciousness of Adam and Eve all over again. That what's about to happen has never happened. And so if we have one a day to live, not and speaking our truth isn't being reactionary. You know, today, even today, with all the difficulties and the war in Israel, and you know, everyone, to me, so many people are responding without reflecting or feeling. They're responding to partial knowledge. It doesn't matter from which side. And so I think that, you know, our challenge is to feel the life we're in and to remember again and again and again, it doesn't have to be this way. It doesn't have to be this way. Everything is unrepeatable. And when we can slow down at the pace of what is real, we have a better chance of feeling that in our heart. And then being true is not just speaking our truth, it's being our truth. We don't have to correct anyone. We simply, you know, everyone's heart is like an inner sun. And our challenge, our vow, is to never let that sun go out, never muffle it. I can choose. I have to make choices in this life. Who's trustworthy to share with? Where can I do this? Where can I do that? But I never let the inner sun go out. And that's what happens when we start to try to please others, when we start to try to hide who we, because when we don't speak or we're silent enough, we lose our voice. Now, when we're not who we are, we become a chameleon.
Yeah, this is so important. And, you know, one of my lessons from this year has been to really live on that growing edge. It's like coming to that place of discomfort and pushing that boundary, like living there to take risks, to do things. And what I've discovered in this year by really consciously living on that growing edge is that that's the only place change and transformation comes from.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is to be fully there and lean in and take those risks. So even using your voice, like you just encouraged us, it's like, when we don't, nothing's going to change, and you can stay in your own world of pain and separation and repetition of what you're not wanting. But you say to live our life is to live what life is right in front of us, and to really go to those edges and push a little bit.
Yeah, and I think that I've learned that there's nothing wrong with working for what we want. And I have discovered over time that often working for what I want is an apprenticeship for working with what I'm given. And that's where my gifts really reveal themselves. And so it's not about what we're after. It's what we find along the way.
Beautiful. Mark, you are an amazing poet and author and teacher and human being, and I enjoy talking to you every time you're on the show and listening to you in any way that I can. I'm wondering if you have a favorite poem.
Oh, well, they're like children, so it's hard to choose favorites. But, you know, there is a poem of mine called Free Fall that I return to a lot, and it goes like this: if you have 1 hour of air and many hours to go, you must breathe slowly. If you have 1 arm's length and many things to care for, you must give freely. If you have 1 chance to know God and many doubts, you must set your heart on fire. We are blessed. Each day is a chance. We have 2 arms. Fear wastes air.
That's a gift. Thank you. Now that's my favorite one as well. I love that. I love that. Free falling. So in your world, before I bring this to a close, I'm just curious, if you have another favorite author that's really influenced you and your work and your outlook on life, is there a favorite book or a favorite author that has made a difference in your life?
Oh yeah, well, first off, there's a contemporary poet, Naomi Shihab Nye, who is a friend, and I just love her work, and she's just an amazing spirit. There's also the work of Abraham Heschel, the Jewish rabbi and teacher, particularly a book of his called The Earth is the Lord's, which because of the Holocaust, he wrote this book trying to convey the Eastern European Jewish mind because so much of that culture was being destroyed. And I also love the Chinese poet Tu Fu from the 700s, as well as Basho, who I mentioned, who's the Japanese poet in the 1600s.
Thank you for sharing those. Wow, that's cool. What message do you want to leave our listeners with today? We're talking about falling down and getting up, and you've had a beautiful influence on so many across the world in so many different ways. I'm wondering what message is on your heart today.
Well, I feel like I would invite everyone who's listening to trust and follow your heart. I think our heart is the strongest muscle and the deepest teacher we have, and it never lets us down. We may feel things that at times feel unpleasant or difficult, but our heart never lets us down, and it can lead us beyond our own biases, which we need more than ever.
Yeah, right there is really good advice of really breaking out of our own biases, our own, yeah, such a powerful lesson. You write about that in the book too, in a couple of the different chapters. Mark, thank you for joining us. That is such good medicine for this holy moment of now. I just am so happy that you've joined us today.
Oh, well, thank you so much. It's great to be with you again, and I look forward to other times too.
Thank you. We've been talking with Mark Nepo, his book, Falling Down and Getting Up. And I want to leave you with two quotes from Mark today. First, no matter how many times we fall asleep or are stirred awake, our recurring challenge is to endure the path wherever it leads so we can arrive at what matters. And finally, our challenge has always been to help each other face what is ours to face so we can be as alive as possible for as long as possible in the tender journey we call love. I'm Julie Kroll. You've been listening to the Dr. Julie Show, All Things Connected. Remember, together we are creating connections for the good of the whole. Until next time, I'm sending you a world of love. Bye for now. If you enjoyed the show, go to your favorite podcast platform. Remember to subscribe, rate, and leave us a review. Also, please consider supporting the Dr. Julie Show at patreon.com/allthingsconnected. When we each give a little, we all get a little more. You can stay in touch with me at juliekrollemail.com. Thanks for listening.